Yeshivat Chaim Berlin. No, I'm just being a little bit. I mean, what we're doing today in this class is sort of reconstructing a what's called a ma'amar, which is the term for Rav Yitzchak Huttner's drashot. So this is a book called The Pachad Yitzchak. It's organized by holidays. And for each holiday, he has a series of kind of drashot that he gives. And the way that he gives these drashot, so he's a 20th century rabbi, early 20th century. He studied in Berlin with the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Soloveitchik. So it's really interesting. He's a really interesting character, really interesting kind of thought partners, whom towards the end of his life, he was really against all of them. So that's some of the background on who this character is. And what he does is he does for the Talmud and for rabbinic literature what the rabbis do for the Torah, I think. That's my opinion of what Rav Huttner does, which is that he will take one source from one place, one source from another place, and weave them together midrashically to make a totally new point. And so we are today going to be doing that process with him for one of his ma'amarim. Is there room for folks to be at the table? I feel like there's few enough of us. There's another seat here that could... Rav Yitzchak Huttner. Yeah.
Why did he choose this name?
The Pachad Yitzchak. So Yitzchak for his name. And then Pachad Yitzchak is in a pasuk in the Torah where I think Yaakov is... I forget exactly what the context of it is. I think Yaakov in one of his, maybe in the dream or something like that, says like Pachad Yitzchak is like one of the terms for God in those psukim. But yeah, feel free to look that up. Pachad Yitzchak's there. So that's just the very brief introduction into who he is. And so this ma'amar comes from his book on Hanukkah. So what do you think the miracle of Hanukkah is?
War got won.
There was war. There were the few against the many, and the few won, right? That's one common understanding of what the miracle of Hanukkah is.
The other common understanding is the miracle of the oil.
Great. The other common understanding is that there was oil. There was a small cruise of oil, and it was only supposed to last one day. It ends up lasting 8. Rav Huttner is going to present us with a third miracle, but it's going to take a little while to get there. And where we're actually going to start is at the very beginning of the Torah, with the second verse of Sefer Bereishit in the first source of your handout. The ha'aretz haita tohu vavohu, v'choshech al pnei tohom, v'ruach Elokim merachefet al pnei ha. Mayim. You see the English there. What would you be asking yourself if you were a good rabbinic midrashist about this verse? Yeah.
That the world did already exist in some form.
Great. The world already existed. But you're thinking really big. The rabbinic midrashists are very focused on each word and the relationship between each word and each other word in this verse. So what question might you have about this verse if you're really focused on what role is each phrase playing here?
What do they mean?
Great, what do they mean?
Tohu, what is that?
Tohu, vohu, choshech, right? These are three different things that sound maybe kind of similar. They all sound negative. Why do we need all three of them, right? That's what the rabbis are often going to ask about synonyms, things that seem like synonyms in the Torah. So what I want you to do is in your chavruta, you're going to read their answer to this question in Bereishit Rabbah. And what I want you to focus on is that I'll give you maybe a little heads up. Their answer is going to be that each one of these terms represents an exile. There were four different exiles, and each of these different phrases represents one of those. And then Ruach Elohim is going to come and sort of sweep away these kingdoms that are exiling our people. So what I want you to look at with your Chavruta is what is, focus on the exile of Greece. What is the content of this exile? What characterizes this exile for the Midrash? And then what is the solution to the problem of exile? So I said that Ruach Elohim is going to come and sweep away the exile, but the Midrash is going to give you some more information about exactly how that works and what enables that. So those are the questions. What is the exile of Greece? What's its content? What's its quality? And then two, what is the solution to the problem of exile in this source? Okay, so you have about 10 minutes or so to work through this first source, which goes until line 7 on the second page. All right, wrapping up and coming back together. Okay, so what do we learn from this source about the Greek exile or the Greek kingdom and the effect that had on the Jews?
The Greeks, as distinct from the Babylonians, allowed the Jews to stay in the land of Eretz Israel, but forced them to assimilate into Hellenistic culture. So they were allowed to remain corporeally there, but their spiritual essence had to be given up to be able to assimilate into Grecian culture, as opposed to Babylonia, where they were taken out of Israel, but allowed to maintain their spiritual essence.
Great, yeah.
By the decree that they should, the darkness, right, this decree of darkness that's being referenced back to, they should write that they do not have a share in Elohei Israel, right? As it says later, forget the Torah. By decreeing that they should forget the Torah, they forced them instead, spiritually as the Maccabees did physically, to find out how to remember the Torah. And so from that, because we can't read the Parshiot, right, we put in the Haftarot, right? And so they began to...
Is that here?
No, that's right. Okay. right? And so they began to get into a way to see it in a new, through new eyes. That there was not going to be darkness because they were still going to carry it in their heart.
Okay, so you're already moving from what's the quality of the exile to what is the redemption from that exile on some level.
Right.
So first, dwelling for a minute with the quality of that exile. So we heard that that exile was going to be a spiritual but not a physical exile. And we've heard that the content of that exile was going to be a choshech, or maybe this is the quality of that exile, is some sort of choshech or darkness, right? That's why the rabbis are connecting it to the word choshech in that first pasuk that we read. And what was this darkness?
Well, they darkened the eyes of Israel with their decrees.
With their decrees, right. And their decrees were designed to bring darkness. And this very cryptic phrase, what did folks make of this? They said to them, write on the horn of an ox that you have no part in the God of Israel.
On the shofar?
On a shofar, maybe. Yeah, what did you think?
The sacrifice in the temple?
Maybe. Yeah, it's really unclear. Rashi thinks that this is a reference to the golden calf. So what he says is that the Greeks were kind of needling the Jews, right? Because in the golden calf, Aaron says, Ela Elohecha Yisrael, right? In this very dramatic moment about the calf. And so I think there's a play here on, right, writing on this kind of related to calf item that you have no part among the gods of Israel. But it's pretty cryptic. When I was just looking now, there's like at least seven different opinions on what that line could mean. But that was Rashi's. An ox. Yeah. Okay. So that's the quality of this Greek exile. And then what does the Midrash suggest is going to be the redemption? What's going to bring about Ruach Elohim coming and giving us redemption from these exiles? Tshuva, right? Tshuva, according to this Midrash, right? Returning to God, that is what is going to bring about the redemption. But I'm sorry, I don't see your name tag, so I'm not sure what your name is. What's your name?
Matt.
No, I think you. Who said?
Joshua.
Joshua. Right, so what Joshua said is good for us to keep in mind around this darkness, because Rav Huttner is going to be picking up on that when he gives us his take on what the redemption from Greece is going to look like. So now I'm going to let you know what he does with this source. So if we look at the Alei Nisim for Chanukah, now I can ask you to read, because you just told me your name, but I forgot it. What's your name again?
Bradley,
can you read for us the Alei Nisim for Chanukah?
Okay, wait, where is this?
It's on page 2 as well, underneath the source we just read.
Oh, I see. Okay. So during the time of Matanyahu, the son of Yochanan, Hasmonean, high priest, and his sons, when the kingdom of Greece stood over your nation Israel to cause them to forget your Torah and to remove them from the rules of your will.
Okay. So this is similar to and different from the source we just read, right? So what's the difference here? What are the Greeks doing to the Jews?
They're causing them to forget as opposed to renouncing.
Great. And so there's this. So what Rav Huttner says is that you should notice that there's an anagram here. There's Hashgacha, and then there's Hachshacha, right? So this is the Choshech, the darkening, but the darkening is a darkening of forgetfulness, right? And so what the Greeks are really doing is they're darkening our eyes by causing us to forget Torah. And what Rav Huttner says is, we didn't talk about this, but in this source there's a fourth kingdom, and that's the kingdom of Edom, not named in this source. That's the kingdom related to the word Tehom, the depth, and this is the kingdom that we are still being subjugated to up until this day. So Rav Huttner says there are four kingdoms. We're in the fourth one, and so we haven't been redeemed yet. So kind of our task right now is to figure out, how is our redemption going to happen? And he says the key to the understanding what the nature of this fourth kingdom is, this fourth exile, it's actually found in the third. It's found in the Greek exile, because it doesn't really say here, right, what the quality of this exile is. It just says it's the depth, it's the worst, it's the deepest, it's really, really bad, but it doesn't really say anything about what it is. And so we have to look back to the third exile, the Greek exile, to understand what's going on. And he says that another piece of information we need to know about the Greek exile is that what happened during this time. We had our first machloket. So at the time of the Greek exile, the first of what are called the zugot, the pairs of rabbis who disagreed with each other, whose disputes are recorded in the Mishnah of Masechet Eduyot, the first of these machloket happened under Greek rule, and he connects that to this hashkacha, hachshacha. And so at the end of this first part of his ma'amar, we get a dire picture. Our exile is the same as the Greek exile. It is a darkness that is related to the forgetting of Torah and is characterized and sort of manifested in dispute and in the fact that there are so many different opinions about everything going on. So that is part A. That's where he wants us to be right now, is this feeling of despair. Like, oh my gosh, there's no stability. There's just kind of multiplicity, no truth. What are we going to do? Yes, Norm.
So the this exile is described as of the evil kingdom. The other exiles were imposed. Do we need to know or think about what the evil kingdom is?
So he kind of flat out says the evil kingdom is, starts with Rome and ends up with wherever we are, kind of. It's this exile that has never stopped since the time of the Romans. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe you're going to go there or he goes there, but certainly before the time of the Greeks, there was machloket, Moshe and Korah. And the first machloket that he talks about is a machloket, l'shem shamayim. It's a positive machloket because it's all about Torah. So what's he do with that, if anything?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're going to get some answer to that, but maybe not as much as you will want. So we can talk about it more once we get a partial answer to that. Yeah. Any other questions about this source or about what he's doing with it? Yes.
So he died before the establishment of the state of Israel?
No. He was like in Berlin, like in the 1929, maybe he was studying in Berlin, but he died maybe like in 1980 or something like that.
So even return to the land is not, he doesn't consider that redemption from it.
No, he does not. Yeah.
The author.
But also, we're currently in the state of setup, right? So we're not yet, we don't know yet what the redemption is. Yes.
One question and then a quick response to that. He does talk about Mashiach as opposed to, right? In other words, the wind of God is about Mashiach, not so much redemption back to the land.
Great. So let's be really clear about what we're looking at. I haven't given you any of Rav Huttner's words.
No.
I am channeling Rav Huttner, but this is Breishit Rabba. So Breishit Rabba is talking about tshuva. Obviously, Breishit Rabba was written well before the establishment of the state of Israel.
In regard to that, if that's the standard, if it's Mashiach, right, that's going to be different than establishing the state.
Right. Okay. Right.
But in any case, the question I had, and you may have you may have already mentioned this. The word, the connection that you made there between darkness, right, and forgetfulness, is there a similar connection for this last fourth period that we're in, the depths? Is there a similar grammatical or verbal connection in terms?
He doesn't make one. He's really focusing on the Greek exile as kind of like the origin for where we are now. He doesn't really actually address much about our current exile besides saying that it's characterized by a lot of machloket. That's the main point that he makes about our exile. And then he goes and turns his attention to investigating this Greek exile, especially because he's really talking about Hanukkah. So that's also why he does that. Okay. So now, he says, however, we can go deeper than this surface understanding. So this is the surface understanding, right? We're in this place of machloket, right? This is where we are right now. And this machloket was brought about by this forgetfulness, darkness, kind of intertwined together. But we can go a little bit further. Rebecca, can you read us Exodus 32:16?
Do you have a language preference?
whatever language you want. You have the other language here, so one whenever I ask you to read, read in whichever language you're more comfortable with, and the others of us who want the other one can fill in with what's on the sheet. So everyone has to pay attention. Yeah. Okay. So when, does anyone know when this is? When is this verse from in the chronology of the biblical narrative? Yeah.
The second luchot.
So this is actually describing the first luchot. Okay.
But it comes after, the description comes after.
I think the description comes, maybe it comes when they're talking about the making of the second luchot, but the point is that this is a description of the first luchot, because what is the quality of the writing?
God did.
Yeah, not just God did it, but where it was engraved on the tablet. So it's both of those things, right? God engraves the first set of commandments onto those tablets. Alvin, can you read what the rabbis have to say about this?
Amar Rabbi Eliezer, my dichti charut al halukhot, ilmalei, lo nishtabru luchot harishonot, lo nishtakha toram Yisrael.
Okay, so you can see why Rav Huttner is bringing this source in, right? What is this source saying about the consequence of breaking the tablets?
We forgot Torah.
Right? So the forgetting wasn't just brought about by the Greeks, right? The Greeks weren't the first to cause us to forget Torah. The first thing that caused us to forget Torah was the breaking of the first luchot. Think about that for a minute.
Isn't that a direct consequence of the golden calf, though?
A direct consequence of the golden calf? Meaning?
Meaning the golden calf was the thing that caused us to forget Torah.
You're saying in the context of the biblical narrative? I don't know. It's a good question. Yeah.
I was going to follow up on that, and it seems that seeing the golden calf, if that's what the people are going to do with the gold, Moshe has in his hands the work of Hashem, right? Surely they cannot have this, for it would become an idol as well, right? So he must throw them down to shatter them, lest they become the god and not God.
You're already you keep anticipating the next step of the argument. No, it's great. It's great. It's amazing. Yes.
I don't know if this is connected to another rabbinic midrash, but the pieces of the broken tablets were put in the ark along with the new tablets. And I think the midrash of the rabbis on that is, even a person who is old and forgets their Torah, it's like the broken tablet. So the forgettingness of Torah later on and the broken tablets, so you shouldn't neglect elderly people who have forgotten their Torah, because don't forget that the broken tablets were put next to the whole tablets. So this idea of the brokenness and the forgetfulness of Torah somehow all being mushed together in the rabbinic legendary mind.
Yeah, but I think that one also is actually doing the same thing in some ways with this verse, right? That the broken tablets are in both the source that you're referring to and this one symbolizing the forgetfulness, the forgetting of Torah.
Are you saying that there's machloket? Are you looking at machloket as a positive thing because that's where I'm focused? Or are you just saying there is a machloket around what we're learning?
Machloket.
Do you see the difference
in the first sort of setup that Rav Huttner is doing? Machloket seems to be negative because machloket is the result of forgetting, and forgetting is the result of, at first, Greek gzerot, and now the breaking of the luchot. So at this point in our ma'amar, machloket is a negative thing. That's going to change. But for now, it's negative. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So now we're going to start seeing the turning point. It's hard for me to see all the name tags, and I'm sorry that this is the first time I'm studying with you, so I don't know any of your names. Oh. Would you mind reading the next source in whatever language you like?
Exodus 34:1. The Lord said to Moses, carve two tablets of stone like the first, and I will inscribe upon the tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you shattered.
Okay. So there's isn't much to say right now about this source besides God's giving the instruction to write the second tablets. Did you actually have something to say on this source? Was that a hand? No. Okay, great. That's all good.
I always thought that, I mean, the first time that I read this, I thought that this was actually those last two words, that this was rebuke.
Interesting.
Now you're going to have to create a second set because you
broke the first one. Oh, that's really good. Thank you for saying that. Okay, so that's an excellent, right? Rebecca's really raising this question, this Asher Shibarta, right? Moshe, you need to build these, you need to bring these second, or build these second luchot because you shattered those first ones, right? Is that how we're supposed to read Asher Shibarta? Or is it more neutral? Yes.
So I don't know how pervasive this is in Chabad teachings, but I know that one, the local Chabad rabbi's son was proudly brought out on Shabbat to say, was Hashem angry that Moshe shattered the tablets? And the little boy said, no, he was supposed to shatter the tablets, because had he not shattered the tablets, then the children of Israel would have been responsible for a grave sin. But where the tablets were broken, it kind of nullified the laws and mitigated the crime to some extent.
Interesting. Okay, so we have three possibilities for how to read Asher Shibarta, right? Possibility A is the way Rebecca read it, right? Maybe pshat of like, ugh, you shouldn't have done that, and now you have to sort of make good on it. Another one's a more neutral, like, you broke them. You got to write, you know, you got to make a new one. And now we're going to see a third one, which is maybe somewhat related to the one that you just shared. Maybe, Common, you can read for us. I happen to see your name tag. Go for it.
Reish Lakish says, sometimes the canceling of Torah is its foundation, as it is written, which you broke. The Holy Blessed One said to Moses, your strength is true, Yishar
Kohacha,
that you broke them.
Great. That's it. Okay, so how exactly? So what's going on? This is actually kind of an auditory pun that the rabbis are making, but they're saying that it's the opposite of what Rebecca initially thought, right? This Asher Shibarta is not a how could you break them, but actually Yishar Kohacha Shibarta, right? So it's not a negative thing, it's actually an excellent, straight, awesome thing that you did by breaking the tablets. Yes, question.
Before, if you recall that verse starts off with God saying to Moshe, I'm going to just destroy the Jewish people. And Moshe sort of says, hold your horses, I'm going to deal with it. My version of it is, I spent more time with them, I sort of know how to deal with them. You know, you're the husband's up there. So I think that what this, Reish Lakish is saying, is God is sort of complimenting him and saying, you prevented me from destroying the Jewish people. And I appreciate that, because I would have just given you a new nation. Mm-hmm. But instead, you came down. Not only did you destroy the tablets, but you also killed, 250,000 people, some number. And, you know, the question always comes up, like, Moshe sort of did what God was going to do, so why did Moshe say to God, you don't need to do, you know, don't do that, and Moshe comes down and does it. So I think that what's being said here is God saying to Moshe, you sort of prevented me from destroying all of them. You left the ones who weren't involved in the Eagle, presumably, or the priests that weren't involved, and now we can start again.
Great. And so yours sort of relating to what you reported about the Chabad rabbi's son who said that, right? I think those are somewhat related to each other as one reason for saying Yishar Kochecha Sheshibarta. However, what happens when you read these two sources next to each other? This is what Rav Huttner is going to do, right? The Eruvin source and the Menachot source. What is the Yashar Kochecha for? Right, this was Eruvin, right? The breaking of the tablets led to Shichecha, which is forgetting, right? That seemed really negative, and suddenly we're being told what? Yishar Koach, right? So suddenly, this breaking of the tablets is also Yishar Koach. What do we make of that, right? So this is where Rav Huttner starts turning, and we start seeing where he's going to go with this question of machloket. Is it positive or negative? But he's starting to lay these seeds of, well, there was forgetting, and for some reason, Moshe's getting a Yishar Koach for leading to that forgetting. Okay.
You've got part of the letters in of forgetting. Shochecha and
Yishar Koach. Oh, nice. Koach and Shichecha. There's strength coming from the forgetting. I like that. Nice.
Nice.
Ooh. Okay. So, now I'm going to send you back into Chavruta. So, what we don't know yet is how come, right? How come the forgetting gets a Yishar Koach? So now you're going to go back to a slightly shorter Chavruta on this source from Temura. And what I'd like you to think about with your Chavruta is, what is the picture of forgetfulness that is being painted in lines 1 to 6? How does Torah end up getting forgotten here, right? And then what happens to Torah in line 7? Okay, so in lines 1 to 6, what's the picture of forgetfulness? And in line 7, what happens to Torah? Okay, let's come back together. Okay, Pamela, do you think you can give us a little summary of what happened here?
Not so much.
That's fine.
So cryptic.
It's really cryptic. It's what about just the first line? Can you summarize the first line for us?
That just during Shiva for Moshe, or whether it was Shiva Shloshim, whatever, that 3,000 laws, so Lot, was forgotten.
Yeah. What does that say about Moshe dying?
Yeah, it was traumatic.
That was what?
It was traumatic.
Yeah.
It was a major loss.
They forgot.
Can you sit somebody at home where they're buried? You don't even know
if they okay, die. So that's a side question, but it's not necessarily related to the question of what the forgetting is about, which is really what we're kind of focused on.
Well, we didn't read it in the negative. What we said is, wow, there are now a whole new, we've got so much else to do. We've got to get to the land, we've got to conquer, we've never been warriors before, we've got to overcome Jericho. We're focused on a lot of other survival mindsets and survival ways of being.
And so because of that, we've forgotten Torah? Is that?
We didn't have time, we just had to survive to conquer the land.
But how do you square that again?
There like 3,000 laws were forgotten
the
in 30
first
days.
Verse of Pirkei Avot, you know, that says Moshe gave it to Joshua, who gave it to the Sanhedrin or the judges, who gave it to so and so, who gave it, and it comes down to us. So there is some legacy. You know, again, people only forget things when they feel like they're no longer relevant to them, and then you have to ask yourself again. Whether it's Greece or Rome or all these other societies that were assimilation became so attractive, what was it about the popular culture that becomes so seductive where people will say, yeah, no, I get it. This really doesn't mean anything to me anymore.
Yeah.
There's another sense of
forgetting and it being positive, and that is perhaps that what was lost was the kind of black letter rule of the mitzvot that were forgotten. But what wasn't forgotten, and as a matter of fact, what replaced what was forgotten was the ability, responsibility, however you want to read it, to come up with these things ourselves, to work on it ourselves.
Great. So now you're jumping to the end of the source, actually, right? So in the beginning of the source, it says that when Moshe passes away, a huge amount of Torah is lost, right? And whether that's because the people are being very focused on other matters, or if it's because really, right, when one person knows so much, right, is it really possible that they've fully transmitted all of that knowledge to the next generation, right? So it's this statement that the rabbis are making of, really, you need to imagine that when Moshe passed away, a lot of Torah was lost, right? Because Moshe was the repository of Torah to some degree, right? So even if Moshe has passed Torah along to Yehoshua, right, how much time did he really have to do that? How much of the Torah that he had in his brain did he really manage to pass along? So I think that what the rabbis are saying in line one is, yes, when Moshe passed away, there was a big loss of the content of Torah, and that shouldn't be minimized. But then by the end, right, as we go through this trajectory, they ask Joshua to see if he can restore Torah by asking either God or kind of telephoning up to Moshe in heaven and saying, we forgot this one, can you help us out? And Yehoshua says, Lo b'shamayim hi, right? This is not in heaven. And the same thing with Shmuel. They asked Shmuel to, Samuel the prophet, to reconstruct these laws that had been lost when Moshe passed away. And he says, no, prophets are not where Torah lies anymore, right? Which is another amazing statement. And then we get this end of the sugya where it says all of these things were forgotten, and now we've suddenly switched from sort of saying halachot, right, which is laws, to these like derivations, rabbinic style derivations. That's why I left them untranslated, because they're each kind of these rabbinic modes of interpretation. So they're saying even those were lost somehow, but Otniel ben Kenaz returned them through his pilpul. And so this is the next step on our journey here, which is that we have Otniel ben Kenaz returning Torah through pilpul. Pilpul being this like logical reasoning is how Torah is getting returned. And so what Rav Hutner says about this source is that when Otniel ben Kenaz returns Torah, it's not just this simple remembering. It's not that Otniel ben Kenaz was able to pick up that phone more effectively than Joshua and Samuel were, right? It's a totally different process. And because it's this different process of logical reasoning, it's not going to return those 3,000 laws kind of word for word, it's actually going to generate even more than what was lost. So this kind of process of reasoning and thinking through and deciding and all of these rabbinic modes of sort of figuring out what Torah is and means, that's what the end of this source is saying, and what Rav Hutner is saying is going to actually increase Torah even to an even greater degree than what was lost.
This is kind of a strange.
It's so unclear to me, and again, I'm not familiar with this particular verse, but how does it just seemed like such a non sequitur? How did he pick this one? It's the name, I get it, but there.
How did he pick this one? Be more specific with your question.
To say that this is that Otniel, son of Kenaz, returned these things. There must be something significant about that verb, or maybe it's not. I'm just not sure how.
Yeah, I think I guess my understanding of what's going on here is that the word lachad, meaning to captor, is that finally someone managed to kind of like get a hold on it.
On what?
On Torah. That's,
this is referring to him capturing a city.
Right. Yeah. But,
not,
right, but this is... But this is a midrash, right? So using the word vayilchadah, what is he loched? We're rereading that yilchadah as capturing Torah to some degree. That's how I understood it. It might not be the most satisfying rabbinic midrash ever. Yes?
I was going to say, I've always had trouble with midrash, but putting that aside, I think what the rabbis had to do here was the temple was destroyed. The rabbis needed to establish themselves. They needed to make the Jewish people feel that they could look to what they were being taught as the actual Torah. So they needed to have a story in which they say, Lo Bashamayim anymore, we're not looking up to the heavens anymore, we're not looking to the prophets anymore, we're looking to our intellect. So when we introduce a concept that, you know, is just intellectually based, that is Torah.
Torah, exactly.
And that's what this is all about. They needed to do that, because if you believe that it only came from Shemayim or from the prophets, you would not have, it truly would have been forgotten.
Yep.
You needed to be able to argue and present to people. So I think that's why that's the site. I think that's exactly why.
Great. Thank you.
I think that they all need to drink before they, we need to drink before we sit and look at this and make it way more.
So this part, this one you're finding harder to understand than the first one? Yes. So I think the main takeaway from this source is that the rabbis talk about an instance of a huge loss and forgetting that gets remedied through pilpul and through intellectual engagement with Torah. So that's the main takeaway from this source. If you missed some of the details of how we got there, for Rav Huttner's sake, he does not care, right? He just wants that one takeaway, that we are restoring what has been forgotten through intellectual engagement. And he says, furthermore, that intellectual engagement pilpul, he's going to connect that with machloket. And he's going to do this by means of a very familiar source to many of you from Eruvin, who would like to read for us. Hasn't read yet. Would you like to read for us? Go for it. You could be next. Yes.
Amar Rabbi Abba said that Shmuel said, for 3 years, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel disagreed. He said, the halacha is in accordance with us, and those said, the halacha is in accordance with us. A divine voice emerged and proclaimed, these and those are the words of the living God, but the halacha is in accordance.
Great. And so what Rav Huttner says about this source is, look, right, there's a machloket. There is dispute. And yet we're saying, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim, right? And so if you think back to the beginning of the source that you looked at in Chavruta, the confusing source from Torah, right, there were 3,000 halachot that were lost, 3,000 truths about how you need to behave. Those were lost, right? But here we have an instance where someone's saying, we know what one of those halachot is, and another person is saying, no, we think you're wrong. We think this is what the halacha is. So that's two halachot that are replacing one halacha that was lost, right? And both of them are divrei Elohim chayim. So even the rejected position is still Torah. Right? And so we have this multiplication of Torah. And Rav Huttner goes on to say that just because that position is rejected now doesn't mean it's going to be rejected forever. Right? And so it's not just lip service to say that they're both Torah and that they're both the words of the living God. Saying that is actually making this statement that we're open to the possibility of being convinced in 3 generations, in 10 generations, in 100 generations, that actually Beit Shammai's position was the one that we should be following. And so this forgetting of Torah, led to Pilpul and Machloket, which led to the generation of way more Torah than what was lost. And so that is where Rav Huttner's going with the kind of positive valence of Machloket, right? And this is why Moshe gets a Yishar Koach for breaking the Luchot and leading to forgetfulness, because Machloket is actually going to yield more Torah. Good questions. Okay, so now I'm going to send you into Charuta for one final source in which Rav Huttner is going to be looking at this source to explore a little bit more about what Machloket is. So in your Charuta, I'd like you to actually spend some time with this source, even though it's not super long. And I want you to explore what is the relationship in this source between Torah, enmity, and love. So there's enmity, right? Enmity.
Enmity.
Enmity. Enmity. Yeah. It's not a word I've ever said out loud before, I don't think. Enmity. What's the relationship between Torah, enmity, and love in this source? Yeah. And maybe more generally, what is the Chavruta relationship for? What's Chavruta about for this source? All right, let's come back together. So I hope you found this source a little bit less frustrating than the previous source, maybe. What did you see here? What is going on? We might need to actually read this inside. Yes, let's read it inside. I think maybe you were going to read the last source.
And it states...
Yes, and it states.
And it states, happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be put to shame when they speak with their enemies in the gate. What does enemies in the gate allude to? Ramachia Bar Abba says, even a father and his son, or a rabbi and his student, who are engaged in Torah together in one gate, become enemies with each other. But they do not leave there until they love each other. As it is stated in the verse discussing the places the Jewish people engaged in battle in the wilderness, therefore it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord, Vehev Besufa, and the valleys of Arnon, the word Vehev is interpreted as related to the word for love, Ahava. Do not read this as in Sufa, Besufa.
Good.
Rather,
yep.
Read it as at its end, Besofa.
Okay. So, what are the rabbis saying here about Chavruta? What are they saying about Chavruta, though? What's the statement they're making?
It's yeah. A fight. But it ends, like, with understanding each other.
Okay, so they're saying, first of all, that Chavruta is a battlefield, right? Even this first line, right, is it's what is Torah? Torah is a quiver full of arrows, right? So Chavruta is this battlefield. And so then what's the process here in line three? What's the process? It's this battlefield, and what happens to the people engaging with Torah in this battlefield? Yeah, I think you were, you know, yeah.
So they might start out with a preset loving relationship, rabbi and student, father and son. And as they go through the process of learning, they clash. Perhaps new ideas come out through that clash, although that's not that specifically addressed. It, but they work through it, not leaving the battlefield until they end up as former enemies in the gate who are still, who are yet again able to speak with each other in life.
Yes. Okay. What else did people think about this? Yeah. Is that, does that accord with how you read
they're
that line?
Very, yeah. Very, very close. It also suggests to me that if we're going to, before we can love our neighbor who may be a certain distance from ourselves, we have to be able to love the people with whom we have the most, the closest relationships to start with. And we and recognize that the that we kind of look for a win-win rather than a a winner and a loser.
Uh-huh.
We have this essentially the same value system that we believe in, talking it out rather than settling arguments or disputes in less helpful ways.
Okay, so both of you are maybe in similar ways, you can correct me if I'm mischaracterizing what you said, seeing the rabbis here as saying this battlefield of Chavruta could lead you for a time to hate someone that you really love, right? And sort of, you're sort of pushing it a little bit more and saying, and your job is to love them nonetheless, right? But these things, but like the act of engaging with Torah might be this act that leads you to actually have a lot of friction with somebody. Did everyone read this line that way? Yeah.
Pretty much, but I would add that we felt that the quiver full of them is not really arrows, but arguments,
yeah.
And that with arguments you can have a rational discussion because there's some balance. But if you show up with no bullets in your gun, you're at the mercy. You have no recourse other than.
Whoa. Okay. That's dark. Yeah. Yeah.
But also, like this third verse that talks about a father and son, that first verse in the Psalms, happy is the man that has a quiver full of them, refers to children.
Yes, that's true.
So could it be a generational thing?
Oh, interesting. So you're, spell that out? What
well,
a generational thing?
So I'm partly thinking we needed to. Moshe's dying was the end of an era. That's why the generation in the desert had to die, and that's why Moshe had to die to go into the land. So that's a new era. And these two are setting up, not setting the parent and child generation against each other, but distinguishing between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
That there's going to be a need to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so easy to...
Mm-hmm. That it could lead to some hatred in the process of moving forward, but then you need to
their own decisions.
Right, but then the point is that relationship needs to somehow bisofa end up leading towards love. Yes.
So I'd like to make a claim that the word together is important. In other words, they're both studying the same text. They're doing this together.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that's beyond them.
You're saying this in one gate.
And together.
Where's the together?
In Torah together.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
There's a third ki'ilu person, a third ki'ilu thing that's with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't read enmity as negative. I say in order for new insights to come about, it can't be schmooze, nice, everything's great, amazing. We have to fight it out. We have to disagree to surface a whole new positive dimension and insight.
Great. So that's exactly where Rav Huttner goes with this. So he says, it might seem on the surface of this source that there is a loving relationship that gets compromised in its, right, whose love gets compromised through the battle of Torah, but they just make sure to commit to like sticking it out together until they love each other again, right? You might think that that's what the source is saying, but actually, says Rav Huttner, what's going on here is that there is love that springs up from the battlefield, right? It's this generative battle that generates new insights, and the love comes from this joint power of creativity. And so the way that he connects this source back to the first source that we read is he says, both in this source and in the exile of Greece, there is a solution, a redemption that actually stems from the problem itself. So the language that he uses, let me read this. For those of you who this is helpful, I'm going to actually read it in the original because it's so beautiful. He says, Harema palata shel yavan hayaba gam mishum ritiya asher huchna mitoch hamaka atzma. Behold, the downfall of Greece had within it also an element of a sort of bandage or a salve for the wound that was kind of fashioned out of the wound itself. So it's this very wild image of the, right, of the healing balm that is actually made out of the wound itself. And I think that really goes back to an insight that you said at the beginning about the darkness being what ends up ultimately being the important element in the redemption from the exile of Greece. And so what we end up with in conclusion, says Rav Huttner, is that more Torah-ness is this kind of creativity of Chavruta is what leads, right? This is the fourth, or the third, sorry, the third miracle of Hanukkah is the creativity that came from the forgetting that leads to redemption. It leads to the new light of Torah, right? These sparks, these light of Torah, sort of taking over the darkness of Greece. So that is Rav Huttner's take on what the power of machloket is and what how Torah can actually be multiplied in the world through a process of forgetting. Questions and thoughts about this? Yes.
You know what year he's writing?
When is he giving this particular one? I don't know what year he's giving this particular ma'amar.
Do you think it's post-Shoah? Do you think he's already in America?
I do think it's post the Holocaust, yeah. That would be my guess.
I think that it makes it even more beautiful to understand that Rav Huttner's venture is to recapture the Yeshiva world. To recreate the Yeshiva world.
Exactly what he's suggesting.
And what he's talking about is how much Torah was lost.
In the Holocaust.
In the loss of Moshe. Torah was lost in the Yeshiva. And he's here, he's really pulling it together. He's saying, in that loss is are the seeds of redemption. And the machloket might not be within his own Yeshiva. I think it's very interesting, you can read it as Chavruta. The machloket might be within the broader Orthodox community and maybe within the broader Jewish community altogether.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think in picking up on that, it's also that, you know, first of all, just can we still believe in God was a big issue, obviously, at that time. But I also think that the rabbis, because they were going to now have fights, who remembers how to do this? What time did we say Marav? Everything you see in the Talmud, I was saying that if, like, we're having a fight and with the rabbis, and we're having this machloket, and there's a third person standing there, that third person's going to say, who knows who's right? They're just arguing about this. So he says this, she says that. We don't have to do either because there's no hard and fast law anymore. And so I think the rabbis were doing this to say, even if you see us disagreeing, even if you see us having a machloket, you can accept both positions. One is going to win, you know, one's going to be the law, but don't be alienated if you see this disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think that that's what the rabbis were doing, but I do agree with you about Rabbi Putner that that was his agenda.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was well worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything surprise you in what he does here? Anything you wish that he went further on?
Well, I don't know if it's a translation issue or not, but when he says they do not leave there until they love each other, well, I don't think that, you know, maybe it always works that way in these two, you know, where you're debating religious matters, but we know that, especially in family situations, you know, you can talk forever and then people stop talking forever to each other.
Right, and I think what he's saying, what Rav Huttner at least is trying to say, is that if the conversation that you're having has that third partner, which is the Torah, at the center, that conversation will probably not inevitably, but at least ideally, lead to love, because not because you're sitting and talking it out forever and ever, but because there's that Torah that's kind of centering
you. That value. You have to share.
Right. You have to share that value and that engagement. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we added a third interpretation to the word sufa. So we said en sufa, in the place of sufa, you'll come out loving. In the end, besofo shel davar, in the besof shela, besof, that whole encounter, in the end, so in the end, and in the place sufa. We wanted to add a third piece, and that is that through a sufa, through an actual storm, a stormy encounter, we will come in the end to a place like Sufa of love. The third meaning of the word Sufa.
Yeah, and I love how you connected that back to the beginning of the Choshech al Pnei Tehom, this kind of, right, the darkness on the deep, the creation that came right after that, is also maybe related to that. Yes.
I'm going to reflect on David's context that he provided about when this may come. It does seem striking that if in the beginning of this fourth exile, the event of the destruction of the temple, right, essentially had taken place, and that's what started the exile, the innovation of rabbinic Judaism as we know it, and the taking from korbanot to tefillot, right, which is how we understand and engage Judaism to this day, is the reality that's come out of those last 2,000 years. If we can take the place we are in the wake of the Shoah as a moment that may raise to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, right? So what happens next? Because if, with the generations that have followed from that, feel as though there's no answer to tefillah, that tefillah now is as useless for some, but for some it has no value the way korbanot no longer had place, what happens next, right? And so what is, and it may be that it's going back to the yeshiva world and for it's for orthodoxy only, but I wonder if in fact instead it is for the greater Jewish community, the greater Jewish world, especially those who didn't have it to return to and don't know how to return to it.
Right, and I think what's really interesting about what you're saying is that, right, if we go back to the first source, the Rav Huttner doesn't actually quote the whole thing of, but where, what is it that leads to redemption in that first source? It was tshuva, right, which maybe is kind of what you're talking about in terms of tefillah on some level, and I'm not, he doesn't quote it, so I don't think he's rejecting tshuva as an idea for what brings redemption, but I think he's also allowing for another option, that what brings redemption is us engaging with Torah, with each other.
Although, to answer his question, I think even more in a different way, if you look at the rise, if you look at the deconstruction of the official movements, and you look at the rise of Hilot and independent Jewish communities, and you see the rise in terms of, like, well, what happens when Tefillot doesn't happen? And you see the rise of special, like, singing services, and now a lot of, you know, synagogues have yoga, and they've got mindfulness services. And, I mean, people are actually, I think, having to respond to that issue and finding new ways to engage, especially young Jews, in offering other ways to engage them other than through, you know, the just the typical siddur service.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, exactly, I think what he's, what the way we can use this Ma'amar of Rav Avner is really to open up what Torah means in terms of its possibilities for renewal. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.